Getting a good night's sleep in Britain has never been so hard. Increased workloads, smartphones with 24-hour email access, and general anxiety have meant that on any given night, over half the population are struggling to fall asleep. But salvation is at hand. The Guardian presents Going, Going, Gone, sponsored by John Lewis, a series of stories by internationally renowned authors designed to help you slip into sleep. A series of stories you'll find hard to finish.
So Full of Shapes by John Burnside. So full of shapes is fancy, that it alone is high fantastical. Shakespeare, Twelfth Night. When James and I discovered we were pregnant, we couldn't have been more delighted. We hadn't been planning it, but that pregnancy was no accident. In fact, we were very happy when we heard the news. James, more than me, if anything. Neither of us had the least reservations. Of course, my work in the studio would have to go on hold for a while. I'm an artist, working mostly with glass, and the chemicals I used back then might have been harmful to a developing child, but that was only to be expected. Common sense, really. James earned enough for us to live comfortably until I was able to go back, and anyhow, I could still work on new designs, and it would be a chance to develop in other directions, maybe go back to painting, which is where I started, and I suppose never really left off. Anyhow, we were very happy parents to be. Maybe too happy. Maybe we thought too much about being parents and not enough about having a child. So it became a big romance, a story we were telling ourselves rather than a practical matter. The first mistake, I suppose, was the decision not to have a scan. We didn't want to know if it was a boy or a girl. We wanted the surprise. That paved the way for the second, more serious mistake. Quite understandable under the circumstances, but in our case, what began as a series of fanciful conversations soon became an elaborate fantasy that, after a while, began to frighten James. So much so, in fact, that he didn't want to play anymore. Trouble was, with nothing else to do, I couldn't stop. We had started with the usual speculations, boy or a girl, what name to choose. Then we moved on to the old what if it's twins question. There was history of twins on my side, and once the idea was introduced, I couldn't stop thinking about it. What would that be like? What if they were identical? Would I be able to tell them apart? Would James? I would follow this line for hours in my own mind. Then I'd come out with some sudden question, and James would play along. Then we'd take it one step further, talking about books we had read, movies we'd seen, where one twin could feel what the other was experiencing, even from a great distance, or they could read one another's thoughts, or, well, the one that got to me was a private thing at first, a nagging little fantasy that, like the proverbial broken tooth, I couldn't leave alone. We had decided that if it was twin girls, we would call them Stella and Laura, which had a nice ring to it. Of course, James didn't really think it would be twins. But I started dreaming up weird scenarios when I couldn't sleep. Where we had two beautiful twin girls. But it was like in some old film where one child is the very picture of goodness and the other is evil. After all, we hear that often enough. The evil twin. I got so involved in this fantasy that I even decided that if we had twins, Stella would be the goody two-shoes and Laura would be the evil, charismatic one. I have no idea where this fantasy came from. It frightened me a little, but I couldn't leave it alone. The evil twin, the good one. Would I love them equally, no matter what they did? Or would I prefer one? And if so, which? Stella or Laura, good twin or bad? And why did I think if one was good, she would be the lovable but dull, while the other would be my favorite? I never mentioned any of this to James, of course, but he sensed something about 6 months in. And he suddenly stopped wanting to talk about the twin question. Or even whether it would be a boy or a girl. He said we should just choose a boy's name and a girl's name and then love this baby no matter what. Only I wasn't sure. Suddenly, I had no idea what it would be like to love a child. Suddenly, it all seemed too much. Like when some horror film you think is about to end suddenly adds another elaborate twist and it begins to feel as if you'll never escape. It wasn't a twin, though. It was a perfectly healthy baby girl. And we called her Stella. Just as we had planned. Well, more or less. To begin with, we couldn't have been happier. But then, as Stella passed her first birthday, and then her second, without uttering a single word, we began to worry. She made noises. Yes, she gurgled. She vocalized. She very occasionally cried. But she did not speak. And for me, this was the most disturbing fact. She never laughed. She didn't even smile. We took her to the doctor. We saw specialists. Everyone said Stella was a perfectly normal child who would, in time, come to speak. Which all sounded fine. But they didn't have to live with her, day in, day out, not smiling, not laughing, not speaking. No mummy. No daddy. No cat. Dog, horse, rabbit, mouse. I read to her all the time. I bought her a little set of farmyard animals and sat on the floor with her, holding them up in turn and making noises. Cow, moo, duck, quack. Nothing. James said I shouldn't worry. But he was worried sick himself, so that didn't help. Besides, he didn't have to be with her every day. He could escape to the office. Or on those endless business trips, saying all the time that he didn't want to go, that he wished he could be at home more often to help out, to what? The implication was that I was doing something wrong. That if he were there, this whole situation would sort itself out. And I resented that implication because I was doing everything I could. I was the child's mother, for God's sake. If she wouldn't speak to me, who else would she speak to? The doctor said she needed stimulation. So I gave her stimulation. I read to her. We watched TV and listened to the radio together. I took her for walks, for picnics. That was the worst part. The picnics. I would take her to a place I had always loved, a patch of grass on a clifftop overlooking the sea. And we'd spread the blanket and lay out the food. Stella was always very careful and keen to help. We would eat, and I would talk to her, pointing things out, saying the names. That went on for a while. She passed her third birthday, and still, nothing. Then one day, we just finished, and I was packing up to go. The remains of our picnic lay on a cloth between us, bread and cheese, some apples, one last little pot of jelly. She liked jelly. And in amongst it all, a short-bladed knife. I was talking about the sun on the water, how brightly it sparkled. And I was watching her mouth, waiting for it to form a word. I suppose I had grown a little desperate, looking out and pointing at the boats in the bay. And suddenly it all seemed too much, like there was too much world there. All these objects and names and the sparkle on the water, the constant play of light on the surface, the smell, the sound of it, the pull of the tide. It was too much. And that was why I cut her. As I was packing up to go, I had the knife in my hand. She was trying to help, clumsily wrapping the cheese in its cellophane, and my hand slipped. Yes, it would have slipped. And I cut her. Just a little, a nick, really, on the back of her hand. Any other child would have screamed. Or cried out, at least, but she just looked down in surprise. Then, having registered what I'd done, she looked back at me. Her mouth opened slightly, then closed again. "Oh, God, Stella," I said. "I'm so sorry. Mummy's so sorry." She didn't speak. She didn't cry. She just looked at me curiously, as if I had suddenly struck her as interesting in some way she hadn't expected. Taking her hand, I pulled a tissue from my pocket and pressed it against the wound. It was nothing, really, just a little scratch. "I'm so sorry, Stella," I said again. "Mummy didn't mean to hurt you." I looked into her eyes. So still. Just mildly curious and at the same time so strange to me. And that was when I guessed. If guessed is the right word. That was when I knew what monster I had created. Even if I had no idea how I created it. I spoke again. I apologized again, but this time. Well, in truth, I don't know why I said it. I'm not altogether sure if it wasn't just a slip of the tongue, but as I laid my hand on her shoulder and turned her around so I could see her, I called her Laura. It must have sounded like a question, but really it was a mother's final desperate appeal. "Laura?" I said. And then again, the appeal in my voice so obvious it pained me. "Laura." Was not and had never been. Stella looked at me properly in the face for the first time and recognized me as someone who was part of her world. And then, after studying me for a moment, taking me in, so it seemed, she smiled. When she spoke, it was clear that she had been waiting for this day all her life, and now that it had come, she was as relieved as she was happy. Her smile widened just a little, then widened more. And as it did, I felt a sudden, sickening revulsion. I said her name again, and this time it wasn't a question. Laura. She looked so happy. But there was triumph there too. "Mummy," she said. Her voice was perfect. Almost overly developed for a 3-year-old. "Mummy," she said. And then she said it again, savoring the word, as if she had been waiting a long time to say it. "I've missed you so much." As if it had been me who'd remained silent all this time. As if it had been me who had refused to return all the love she had been offered. That smile lingered for a moment longer. Then her face clouded, as if she had suddenly remembered some bad dream from long ago. A bad dream that had puzzled her for years. Finally, after a moment's thought, her smile returned and she looked me in the eye. And that look, a look of cunning and mock innocence and complicity, cut me to the quick. "Who is Stella, Mummy?" she said, with just a hint of mockery in her voice now, to match the mockery in her eyes. "Is Stella coming to live with us?" I stared at her. I think I believed that if I closed my eyes and went deep inside my head, she would disappear. Like some phantom in a daydream. "No, darling," said. To my horror, I realized that I was frightened. "Nobody is coming to live with us. It's just us." She nodded slightly, and she looked down at her hand to where I'd cut her. "I'm glad," she said. "I'm very, very glad. Because I would never want anyone to come between us." There was a long pause, and she looked up into my eyes and gave an odd, joyous little laugh. "I just want it to be you and me, Mummy. Just you and me. Forever and ever and ever. Amen."